Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marge Regan. GM made big news earlier this year by making Mary Barra the first female CEO of a global automaker. Today, Barra and GM are in the spotlight for a very different reason, a long overdue recall on millions of cars and at least 13 deaths resulting from a defect. Her testimony last week has received the Saturday Night Live treatment just this past weekend.
Miss Barra, when did you first find out about the ignition problem?
That's part of our investigation.
So you don't know when you knew?
I am looking into knowing when I first knew about it. But I won't know the results of that knowing until I know for sure.
Unfortunately for Barra, there's not a huge distinction between parody and reality.
You don't know whether or not anything happened after that investigation.
I don't have the complete facts to share with you today.
Okay, well, that is incredibly frustrating to me. When that lawyer for General Motors left that hearing, who did he report to?
I don't know which lawyer was at that trial, so I can't answer that question.
When Mary Barra was first named CEO, we talked to Nancy Kane about her. She joins us again, as she does every Tuesday for Open Mic, for her take on how Barra is managing the situation and how she got where she is to begin with. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration. Her most recent book, Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Nancy, good to see you.
Always good to be here.
So we were handling this, as Jim said. You know, this is a big deal. Woman running an auto, big General Motors, very exciting. But now the theory is that she's been thrown under the bus, that she's just a sacrificial lamb, the CEO that came in after this all happened, to take all the blame. Is that as sexist as some people are saying it is, Nancy Kane?
You know, that's a rumor, or you will, if that's a headline kind of racing around the, you know, the circulation system of the internet. You know, I find that very hard to believe. I find it very hard to believe that someone who had been with a company this long, with, a very impressive track record in all the different positions that she'd had. She clearly, right, been on a kind of executive fast track, if you will, by virtue of the very different kinds of promotions she received. I find it hard to believe that the board of directors would support someone who in some sense was going to be a sacrificial lamb. I just don't believe it. It doesn't feel true to me.
Okay, good.
It doesn't exonerate her, and it certainly doesn't exonerate the corporation and all the other folks that were involved in the series of decisions that led to this absolute disaster. But I really think it's very hard to believe that this corporation at some very high level decided, here's the person that we can sacrifice, and it will be the first female CEO. Of General Motors.
I don't find it hard to believe at all. Now, I'm not an historian at the Harvard Business School, I must admit, but this week we have read of examples of exactly this. Erin Callan, this woman at Lehman Brothers in 2008, made CFO, who most people, I've read a lot about her this weekend, said was not even the most qualified person to get the job. She's thrust into the middle of this thing. Now she lives in some small house somewhere on Long Island or something like that. Why is it so hard to believe? It is an old boys network for decades and decades and decades. The notion that I've read, and you're right, it's just a theory, is, well, maybe the public will have a more empathetic response because there's a woman and it's softer, even though she hasn't been able to answer any questions about anything. Why do you find it so hard to believe?
Well, first of all, Mary Barra has a really good track record. It's not like she just had all these different roles and, you know, hit singles, so to speak, right? I mean, she hit lots and lots of home runs. And she spent all this time there, again, you know, climbing the ranks, moving vertically as well as horizontally. The higher up she got, the more kind of different positions they gave her, a step or two below CEO. And quite honestly, I think Dan Ackerson, her predecessor, he left because his wife has stage 4 lung cancer. I this is an Oliver Stone question, right? It's an Oliver Stone kind of hypothesis that all these dominoes were set up to fall in a certain way so that Mary Barra would take the hit. It just doesn't ring true to me. Now, was she appointed the first woman CEO, you know, in an extraordinarily male-dominated industry as something of a reputational or public relations move? Absolutely. But there's a big distance between that piece And we knew what was coming down the pike. So we said, Mary, you go out in front of the bus.
By the way, let me be clear. I'm not suggesting by saying I find it credible that she's not competent, even though I think her testimony was not competent. Her resume is spectacular. I'm just saying that doesn't preclude the notion that the boys in the boardroom decided this is a good time to pick a woman.
We're talking about Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. What I find so weird is I know that Ackerson, the CEO before, his wife is very sick and he stepped down. But I don't understand why he isn't there. At least he could take a couple of days off from being.
You mean
being
in front of Congress?
Yes, because he was the person.
That's a very interesting question. Where is he? And where are some of the other folks, right? I mean, so just for a second, putting aside, you know, the possibility, I think, again, a little bit Oliver Stone-esque that this was a kind of setup by the board and executives at GM, including Ackerson, because he would have had to be in on it, if you will. Putting aside that question for a second, we still have a series of questions about how did this happen, and how is GM handling it, given what you know has been uncovered in public sources about this. So one of the things that's fascinating to me is how many different people in different places in the company knew something about this, right? All the way back a decade when the first ignition switch has the problem, just for our listeners who don't know the details, you know, the problem with these cars, Cobalts, Saturn Ion, some Pontiacs, that's a Chevrolet Cobalt, some of these smaller cars that GM makes, is that the ignition had a spring and parts problem in which if you had heavy keys, lots of stuff, including the fob to start your car remotely, on your key ring, and that weight could trigger a spring that actually in the ignition that actually switched the ignition from active running to accessory, in which case the car went off. And the interesting thing here is they think it's a computer algorithm problem. The airbags didn't, right, deploy.
So, well, so you can't
your car
steal.
Can stop.
Steer,
you can't steer.
Me.
No brakes.
You may have no brakes, and you have no airbag. So it was a disaster to begin with. There is now beginning to be evidence, as it was known as long as a decade ago. There was a discussion and a series of decisions several years after the discovery about switching ignitions. Delphi was one of the first tier auto OEMs, original equipment manufacturers for GM, right, was the maker. There was a discussion several years after the discovery about a fix. That fix was made, but it was known then that fix wasn't quite adequate. So you have this fascinating and terrifying and reprehensible set of decisions made in a big decentralized, still multi-divisional organization, multi-divisional corporation, right, goes all the way back to Alfred Sloan and the founding of the company, these silos, so to speak, that were made around something that was fundamentally unsafe and that was continued. And there is now a new, recently uncovered bit of evidence that the company, and some of this has come from court testimony and documentation in lawsuits brought against GM for wrongful death. There is now recent information that when they made that switch, a couple of years after the original discovery of the problem, they made a switch that turned out not to be adequate, made a change in the parts. They didn't change the parts number, which is why they have to recall 2.6 million, because there may be cars that are less, in some sense, risky to drive because they have the newer switch
but
still.
But they can't tell.
But they can't tell. So now, did they cover up? So the real question, I don't think, is even was Barra, was she set up? The real question is, how did this happen?
Why can't I? I'm going to posit something.
One more comment. Why won't GM, why isn't GM stepping up to own it? Like the small number of companies do when there's a big, big, you know, safety blunder or mistake or a set of mistakes.
Well, let me add one question to your list and then I'll try to answer one of yours and see what you think of it. And why hasn't one single person in the whole company been fired? Let's go back. Here's my analysis as to why they decided to deal with this thing for a year. For a decade. And this is as much a question as a statement, Nancy Kane. Major corporations make calculations of risk and benefit on everything. What they say to themselves is, hey, the worst that's going to happen someday, maybe 13 people are going to die. The worst that's going to happen is we'll have to pay a big fine, which really doesn't come out of our pockets. and nobody's going to go to jail. So let's just keep milking this until we can. We save money on the on a potential recall. The government has no power. We'll get to them in a couple of seconds. And the Toyota settlement recently, which was celebrated throughout the land by the Justice Department, is a perfect example. At least five people died there because of the stuck accelerator. No criminal charges. A $1.2 billion fine, which the executives won't have to pay, and an admission of guilt. I assume the GM guys thought, this is what's going to happen. I mean, Toyota's recent, but that's what's going to happen to us at the end of the day. We pay a big fine, no harm, no foul. Let's keep making these defective cars. Isn't that a fair characterization of what probably went on inside GM?
Something like that certainly went on in GM. Something like that. And I'm taking the recycling out this morning, and I'm thinking about exactly that. I'm thinking, like, so you're someone who knows what's going on. You're Ray DiGiorgio, right, who is one of the one engineer at GM that knew very early on about this problem. Right, he denied knowing about it in a lawsuit a year or two ago. And is still working at GM. In fact, Mary DeBarra was asked about him in the congressional testimony last week, and she said he has not been fired. So we have an accountability problem. Unfortunately, let's all heave a sigh. It is not a new problem in parts of corporate America, but I think this question, right, about I'm putting the recycling down on the curb, and I'm thinking, so you are an engineer. You've worked on this. You're Ray DiGiorgio. You're one of his colleagues. You know about this. It's 2007, 3 years after the first problematic, you know, ignition part was discovered, or ignition switch was discovered. You go home at night. You kiss your kids, right? What is it? How is it? Now, we all have our, you know, we all have our darker sides and things we are accountable for and things we wish we'd done differently. But you live in a, you're working in a culture in which the candor and accountability and in some sense, safety first is obviously not reinforced. Or you would have, you know, kissed your kids and said, I got to do something about this, as we know many whistleblowers do, so to speak. Or, you go and you talk to your boss and you say, we got to make this right. So how does that happen? And how does a culture allow that or discourage the higher road? That, to me, at a very human level, is just fundamentally compelling, that question. And, you know, I keep thinking about Lincoln. Forgive me. He's my default. And I keep thinking about what he said to people who would, like Frederick Douglass, who would, you know, who would really protest and bemoan the terrible immorality of slavery. And he said this. And it's not a relativist comment. He said it's a comment on human nature and human behavior. He said, I'm not sure they are so different, slaveholders, as we would be in their position. So I keep saying, would I, if I were in General Motors, if I were Ray DiGiorgio, would I have gone to my boss? Well, I would have if the culture or the leadership sent a certain kind of signal. But it might have been very hard for me. I might not have. If the culture was about risk calculation and let's get it done, and mm-hmm. here's my silo, and make sure you get X number of SUVs out now,
I think the culture would be different if they thought there were criminal indictments at the end of the
you
line.
You bet it would be. Yeah, you bet it would be. And there's a lot of talk about that now in the media, right? That this should be a Justice Department problem, because once you start making these issues criminal, right, people's behavior from the top down changes real quick. It's going to be hard to do that, but certainly that
Why?
Seems like...
Why is it going to be hard to do that?
Because just in terms of how you... Criminal liability standards are very, very different.
Okay.
And a lot of corporate law, including corporate structure, right? The legal parameters of corporate structure are designed to make certain kinds of criminal indictments more difficult.
You know what I wondered too, which is very upsetting as well, assuming that that people were like the slaveholders know better than anybody else would be in this situation, or we'd
we
all
didn't
be
say
like
they're
this
no better. So we would
be like them. We would be like them, which is really depressing to think about. But then you have this government agency, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, which is supposed to be looking for this kind of malfeasance. And what was their very discouraging role in this? Because they knew about these problems, too, and apparently didn't do much.
Right. Well, you know, the relatively recent chairman, right, of that agency said last week before Congress, I didn't realize that we could issue subpoenas for these kind of documents from General Motors. So then you put your head in your hands and you shake your head And you think, what is going on? You know, the National Highway Safety Transportation Agency, this is their job. And they don't, the you know, he's been in the job a year. He comes out of environmental standards and fuel economy work. And you don't know that you can go to the one of the world's largest automakers and say, we need to find out about an ignition flaw that may cause wrongful death? What?
You can't. I thought at first it would be about a money thing. They didn't have the money because there was a great little factoid that the entire investigative branch of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. I always have to look at that to make sure I get it straight. Their whole investigative budget is the same as Barra's $10 million salary.
It's less than Barra's salary.
Yeah. So they don't exactly have a lot of money. But this wasn't about money. They did know about it.
Yeah. No. It seems to have been about two different things. One, you know. If you will, a cone of ignorance or a bubble of ignorance at the very top, including, you know, we didn't know we could subpoena documents or subpoena information. And secondly, some kind of tsunami, you get the sense, right, of information coming into the agency that, just like GM, got filed away in small channels and got stuck there. So I think it's important for our listeners to realize that the General Motors, since its very founding, right, really became the corporation we know today in the 19-teens and the 1920s, largely in opposition to the success of Henry Ford. But it was designed to produce many more different kinds of cars than the Model T. So it was anything that a consumer wanted, a Chevrolet, an Oldsmobile, a Buick, a Pontiac, later a Cadillac, it was designed in silos. It was the most successful creation of what became the corporate structure. And so from its very beginnings, this company has lived in these kind of grooves. It doesn't exonerate them. Quite the opposite. I'm suggesting as a business historian that this is an organization that since at least 1980 has been living in the past. Right, and has lived in a structure that no longer makes sense strategically for an auto manufacturer, no longer makes sense for what the public and government expects of business, no longer makes sense, you know, ethically. You think about 2008 and 2009, the automakers flying in, all but Ford, flying in their private planes, right, to ask for money. And you just realize that this is an industry, or this is a part of the American economy, very important part, that seems still today massively out of touch with what goes for good business. And I think we see all those threads, you know, kind of woven in to this moment in General Motors history. I do not think, regretfully, that it's a moment that will necessarily break the company, because this company, more than almost any other corporation I can think of that is as old as it, needs a wake-up call. So, right? It needs a wake-up call ethically. It needs a wake-up call structurally. It needs a wake-up call culturally. It needs a wake-up call.
So Nancy Kaye from Harvard Business School, this is more about the culture of General Motors and the automakers, and it is about something uniquely American about American corporations.
Absolutely.
I mean, you hear about the Japanese falling on their swords when some terrible thing happens over there.
That's not what exactly happened in the first months after the Toyota disaster in 2010. They came around to falling on some kind of sword.
So it's not American. It's just...
No.
You said something a minute ago before Marjorie asked that question. I want to talk for just the final minute or two about fixing the image of this company. I don't know if someone's about to buy a small car right now and you have a choice between a small GM car and a small car made by another manufacturer. I don't know why unless you've been buying GM since your grandfather was alive, why you'd do that. It seems to me that Barra's made one good decision and one horrific decision. The good decision is she appointed Ken Feinberg, who, as everybody knows, did the 9/11 fund, did the Boston Marathon One fund, all this sort of
thing. Gulf of Mexico oil spill fund.
Yeah, BP, right, and all that sort of stuff. That's a real plus. And the hope is that they're not going to invoke this immunity thing that they have because of the bankruptcy in 2009. However, while people say, you know, give her some time, she's only been there 3 months, 2 months, 2.5 months, give her some time. I interviewed the other night Phil Troutwine, whose sister died in a Chevy Cobalt in 2009. Phil and his mother were unbelievable in Washington. They had a private meeting with Barra with some of the other victims. What he said to me, which I didn't know, is of the 13 deaths that even GM admits were as a result of the defect, they have notified none of the 13 families. Now, while the Troutwines believe they're one of them because they hired their own investigator, and their own investigator said the airbag didn't deploy, which gets back to what you said before, the fact that because they're lawyered up, that the new GM under the new Mary Barra can't say to the 13 families to put them out of some piece of their misery, your daughter, your husband, your whatever died as a result of our,
I agree.
To use Margie's word, is unconscionable.
It is
to
unconscionable.
Me.
It's unconscionable. It's unconscionable ethically. It's unconscionable culturally. Think of the signal they're sending to all their employees about what kind of company they work for. It's unconscionable strategically. So I was thinking as I drove over here today, what are some companies that have made right by real disaster? So let's go way back to 82. Johnson & Johnson and Tylenol.
And I predicted they would be out of business
and
in
so did
six
everyone
months.
Else. Yep. And so did everyone else. And James Burke stepped
We should
up.
Say what happened for those who
okay,
don't recall.
Okay, so 1982, some cyanide-laced bottles of Tylenol were found in Chicago. It was later found to have been kind of a psychopath who did that. But
I didn't even know they found the. I didn't even know they found the person.
I believe so. Okay. I believe so. So in any event, James Burke, CEO at the time, basically stepped up to the microphone, Harry Truman-like, and said, "The buck stops here. We own it." And immediately recalled, you know, $100 million worth of Tylenol off all the nation's shelves. They then, same week, like started working with the FBI and the Chicago police, trying to figure out what happened. They also then went on to pioneer. Right, this new safety cap that we all now struggle with, but is actually in some ways a good thing because you can't walk into the store and do something crazy. But the most important thing they did, Jim, was to step up and said, "This is our problem, our responsibility. Mm-hmm. We own it." Right? Think about that. That was so powerful for not only people's sense of what might come of this, but it was enormously powerful for their reputation. It actually launched Tylenol over time. Into an even higher position in the market than it had been. Dave Needleman, 2007, JetBlue, problems because of weather. I won't blame the weather. We handled this terribly. Remember all those JetBlue airliners that were stuck on the tarmac and people suffering?
Yes.
He said, "We own it. This is not weather. We're going to change everything." Communicated with every single person that had been on those planes, right? Said free vouchers, we'll take care of any healthcare costs that came as a result of this.
Wow.
Again, complete ownership. You know, so very different than what we see here with General Motors.
Okay.
Or Ford and Firestone, right? 10 years ago, 12 years ago.
So in light of that fact, in the final 30 seconds we have, do a little Nostradamus work. Nancy Kane, you're sitting with us. What's this, beginning of spring of 2014? It's the beginning of spring of 2016. We're talking about Abraham Lincoln with you again. And is Mary Barra still the GM, CEO of General Motors?
I'm sorry, what year? How many years?
Two years from now. Will theoretically have weathered this storm. Feinberg will agree upon some compensation figure for the families. Her testimony arguably will be forgot. Will she still be there, or will she be the sacrificial lamb that Marjorie referenced at the top of this discussion?
I'm hesitating. It's interesting, having come out very strong for not thinking she was. I think I'm gonna err on the better angels of our nature side, and you can call me on it, you know, in 24 months, and say she will still be CEO.
And you'll be here in 24 months with us?
Oh, you bet. And she'll have found her sea legs, and hopefully this will make her stronger and braver.
Fair enough. Nancy Kane, as always,
well,
thank you so much.
People are very understanding, I think, in general, if you...
Own it.
Exactly.
Own it.
Nancy Kane, always great to talk to you. Nancy Kane is an historian at the Harvard Business School, where she holds the James E. Robeson Chair of Business Administration. Her most recent book is Ernest Shackleton, Exploring Leadership. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Please tune in tomorrow. Brian McGrory, editor of the Boston Globe, is going to be with us. Bob Mankoff, he's the cartoon editor at the New Yorker. He's going to be with us. And he's also going to give you hints on how to win the cartoon blurb.
The caption contest.
Caption contest every week in the New Yorker. I am Marjorie Egan. He's Jim Browdy. Our show is a production of WGBH Radio. Our team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roslip, John Parker, and Amanda McGowan. I'm sorry, I didn't get to... You could say your own name.
Can I say I'm Jim Browdy?
You can say.
You said I was
Marjorie
Jim Browdy.
I am Marjorie Egan. I am not Jim Browdy. Who are you?
I am Jim Browdy. You were right.
Jim Browdy. God, I can't believe I finally met you. Please tune in again tomorrow. Thanks for listening.